This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
This evening's topic is cognitive aging and function. So this is our fourth talk, and we have two more, one on prognosis and how to apply that to one's personalized medical care, and then finally advanced care planning. So those are two great talks coming up. We have an incredible session tonight. This is an incredibly relevant topic, one that I find very important in my own clinical work. We have two incredible speakers. So the first is Dr. Ann Fibini. She's part of our Division of Geriatrics, very accomplished geriatrician, and in fact, the reason I went into geriatrics, she was my mentor when I was in medical school. And she went to the medical school at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health and did her family medicine residency there as well. She then moved to Boston to train in geriatrics at Harvard Medical School.
Which is where I met Anna.
Yes, that's where I was a student. After she finished her training, spent the next 19 years there taking care of patients both at Hebrew Senior Life and the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. And she ran both outpatient and inpatient programs at both those institutions. She taught medical students, me included, residents and fellows at all the Harvard teaching hospitals, and led geriatrics fellowship program for 5 years. A year ago, she moved here. It was quite the coup for us, and moved to San Francisco to become the associate chief of staff for geriatrics at our San Francisco VA Medical Center. And she's an associate professor of medicine here at UCSF. She's delighted to live and work and be able to spend the evening with you tonight. After that, Mr. Craig Wingate will be joining us from the Alzheimer's Association as well, and he'll be talking about other elements of cognitive aging and perhaps even dementia. So he's an outreach and marketing specialist at the Alzheimer's Association, and he's been there for over 3 years. His responsibilities include helping to increase awareness about Alzheimer's disease, educating African Americans and medical professionals about this disease, and the supportive programs and services offered at the Alzheimer's Association. His educational background includes a bachelor's degree in psychology, a master's degree in public health, and a second master's degree in international marketing. Outside of the association, Craig is a marketing consultant who helps health-related nonprofits reach their marketing goals. When Craig isn't working, you'll either find him at the gym or in front of a piano practicing and writing songs. Unfortunately, we do not have a piano here tonight. Darn it. But this clearly is going to be a great session, so thank you all for your attention, and I'm going to invite Dr. Ann Fibini up first. Thanks.
I'm generally a walker and talker when I give talks, but I have been instructed to post myself here because of the microphone, so I might lurch away every once in a while, so forgive me. I'm really, really pleased to be here and made a rookie mistake, although I'm not a rookie teacher at all, in that I did not create a slide with my goals or my objectives for you for the evening, so I'll give them to you verbally. And as the slide makes clear, I'm going to talk about thinking and doing cognitive aging and function. And I'm going first because I'm going to talk about what's normal with aging. And Craig is going second because he's going to talk about the abnormal, what's abnormal about aging and cognition. So my goals for you all are to give you a sense from the slide that you've already seen, if you've looked at the paper handout, of how long you might expect to live. Because life expectancy is a really key element in how geriatricians approach the care of older adults, because it matters enormously how much longer you're going to be around when making decisions about what sort of medical care makes sense, what sort of life choices to make. And so that's the first part of the presentation. And then the second is to review with you some of the normal changes with aging that occur. And many of you, I'm sure, could tell me yourselves the changes that you've already experienced. And then the last thing is to introduce the concept of resiliency and aging. And as I was doing this, I'll turn to Anna and Louise. It's potentially a topic for a whole talk at a future Osher Mini Medical School, aging and resiliency. Because it turns out, not surprisingly, that it's true at every age and for older adults, that the more resilient you are, the more enjoyment you get out of your later years and the more fulfilled and well you feel. So just going to introduce that topic to you. And as one of the handouts that you should have been, that was on the table, I saw it, is a handout from the Arizona Center on Aging. And if you haven't ever visited that site, and their website is there, www.aging.arizona.edu. And if you didn't pick up this handout, there's some on the table. You can get one as you exit. They have a great handout called Resilience in Aging. And I, as I was reading it, I wanted to put down everything that was on the page in slides, and I thought, well, that's foolish. I'll just provide you with a handout, so something that you can take home and refer to. So, first, how long are you likely to be aging? And I just want to take a quick survey. Is there anybody here who's younger than 65? Oh, so, right, including me. So, about a third, maybe. How about 65 to 75? Yeah, 65 to 75. Anybody 75 to 85? All right. And how about, all right, how about older than 85? Oh, interesting. There's nobody older than 85. Well, in the world of geriatrics, you're not old until you're 85. So that's some of the good news. So this table is from the National Vital Statistics Reports from 2015. It's a year old. And these life expectancy numbers are the average for men and women, Hispanic, Black, and non-Hispanic whites. So this is an average. And for all you women in the audience, you can add about a year to what's listed on this table, and for the men, you can take away about a year. That's the bad news. And so you can see that there's an expression in geriatrics, too, the longer you live, the longer you live. And if you're one of those people who's 65 or 66, and you're a woman, you actually have a life expectancy of another 20 years. So you can see then if you turn 85, you have another 8 years. And if you turn 92, you have another 3 years. And if you turn 95, you have another 3 years. And the remarkable thing is that once you're 100 or over, you still have a life expectancy on average of 2 years. And then if you live those 2 years, you have another almost 2 years, et cetera. So obviously, everyone always dies. But it's just by way of saying that if you reach a certain age and you are generally well, that you can really expect to live a long time. And life expectancy has gone up over the last decade for women in this country a little bit more than it has for men. So this is just to give you an idea of how much longer you'll be walking the earth. And so for most of you, given that most people in this room are younger than 75, it's anywhere from 20 more years to 11 more years. It's a long time. There are many normal physiological changes with aging. And it's really important to distinguish those from the pathological changes of disease and illness. And there's a great joke that a patient told to me years ago to illustrate that point. 85-year-old guy comes to his doctor because he's got terrible knee pain. It's really affecting his ability to walk up and down stairs and do the things he wants to do. So the physician examines his knee and sits back down and says, well, at 85, what can you expect? And the patient looked at the doctor and said, well, my other knee is 85, and it doesn't hurt. So it's just a reminder that a lot of what we as a culture think of as normal changes with aging are actually pathology. They're illness, they're disease. And in some cases, we haven't quite figured out the distinction between disease and normal changes with aging. And arthritis is one of those problems that is so common in older adults that we're not quite sure if it's something that should be considered normal, but for the most part, it's not. And I have a lot of patients who I have to convince of the fact that they're not sick. They're old, but they're not sick. So here are some normal changes that are specific to this idea of function and cognition. I could spend an hour up here reviewing all the different changes, but I didn't want to go into too high a level of detail or talk too long about that. So these are the ones that really have to do with your ability to move around in the world. Your heart has valves, and the valves of the heart thicken and get stiff, and that just means that it's harder for the blood to flow over the valve. It's harder for the valve to open and close. Your maximal heart rate, or the speed that, how can I put it grammatically correct? Your heart can't beat as fast as it used to as you get older. So your maximal heart rate decreases because there are electrical cells in your heart that cause your heart to beat, and you actually lose them. They die. So your heart literally cannot beat as fast as it used to. And that starts to happen certainly by the time you're 60. So that's why master elite athletes just cannot achieve whatever records or speed, agility that they used to be able to achieve, because literally their hearts cannot beat as fast to meet the demands of their working muscles. So that really does limit how vigorously you can engage in activity. And then a lot of older adults are actually taking medicines that slow the heart rate, and that can really affect your stamina and your endurance. Your heart gets a little bit bigger, and especially the left ventricle, and that's the left ventricle is the part of the heart that pushes the blood out into the rest of your body, into your head, arms, legs, belly. And the heart wall also thickens so that the amount of blood that ventricle or the chamber can hold might actually decrease. So not only does your heart beat more slowly, or not only does your heart can't beat as fast as it used to when you stress it, and it also can actually be pumping less blood because the chamber that holds the blood has actually gotten a little smaller. So under normal circumstances, your heart continues to adequately supply all the parts of your body, but an aging heart might be slightly less able to tolerate increased workloads under stress, which would be exercise, for example. So I see patients on Monday mornings, and I just saw a very fit 84 patient of mine who came in and said, "I really have to talk to you about something." He was quite distressed. And it turns out what he wanted to talk to me about was the fact that he loves to hike and camp, and he just can't hike as hard or as long as he used to. And he doesn't sleep as well when he's camping as he used to. So that's just by way of saying that things that you used to be able to do with great maybe vigor, you just can't anymore. And that's normal. You can still do them, but you're not going to be able to do them as hard or as fast or as long as you get older. But it's still important to do them. So exercise is a kind of stress, but another kind of stress is illness, including infections, emotional stress, injuries, and, as I described, physical exertion. There are lots of changes in your lungs, I only included a few details. So the alveoli are the little pockets in your lungs that actually hold the air when you take in a breath. And the alveoli are surrounded by capillaries, and the oxygen moves from the alveoli into the blood vessel and supplies your body with oxygen. So you have fewer alveoli that actually work, and the capillaries, the tiny, tiny little blood vessels that go to your lungs, their walls get a little bit thicker, so the oxygen and the carbon dioxide don't move across those cell walls as well as they used to. And there's a decreased surface area available for that exchange. You know, you blow out carbon dioxide and you breathe in oxygen. So your body, your lungs do a less effective job of pulling the oxygen out of your blood and then sending the carbon dioxide out. And what this means is that there's lower oxygen supply to your vital organs, especially in the setting of a respiratory or a lung illness. So your lungs are already not quite normal as you get older, and then if you get a pneumonia or if you have lung disease, then it's even harder for your lungs to supply your body with oxygen. So it's normal to lose some of that ability to maximally get oxygen out of the air that you breathe and blow out the CO2. Your muscles, I should have said your skeletal muscles, so those are the muscles in your legs and arms. There is something called sarcopenia, which means a loss of muscle mass and the power, the force that the muscle can generate when it contracts. So that's normal to lose some muscle mass. And I have a wonderful picture that I wasn't able to include here of Jack LaLanne. I always love talking to older adults because they know who Jack LaLanne is. I've given this version of this talk to medical students and they just look at me. I have no idea who Jack LaLanne is, but I grew up watching Jack LaLanne on television at this exercise show. He's the first American to have an exercise show on television. So there's a great picture of him in his 20s when he was still a professional bodybuilder. He's this big hulking guy. He looks like Arnold Schwarzenegger used to look. And then there's a wonderful picture of him at age 93 because he lived for a long time. He just died recently. And he was still exercising. He was still lifting weights. But he was probably my size by the time he was 93. And it was just an example of how even if you work hard to increase your muscle mass, you can never have the muscles as an older person that you did as a younger person. Unfortunately, it's just not possible. You can maintain a lot of your muscle mass, but you do lose some of it, even if you work hard at not losing it. And some of this muscle loss is due to diminished growth hormone production. However, I will tell you quite adamantly, do not take growth hormone as a supplement. Bad idea. It's not good for you. But your body makes less growth hormone as you get older, and so it's one of the reasons that you lose muscle mass. But we're still not exactly clear about how much of the loss of muscle is due to aging versus disuse. Because it's certainly true that if you don't use it, then you definitely lose it. And sarcopenia is associated with increased fatigue and a risk of falling. And I'm going to guess that when Dr. Chodos gave you her talk, she talked about the get up and go test. So that's a good test to see whether you've got the muscle mass that you should have. Oh, I definitely can. So the get up, and for those of you who weren't at Dr. Chodos' talk, the best functional test of lower extremity strength in older adults is the get up and go test. And it's hard to demonstrate in these chairs because the seats flip, which is an doesn't work. You should sit in a chair where your knees are bent at 90 degrees and your hips are flexed at 90 degrees. And then you should put your arms across your chest and stand up. So in other words, stand from a sitting position without using your arms to push off. And if you can do that, anybody who's younger than 65 should be able to do it on one leg. Yeah. So for those of you who are younger than 65, Craig, you go to the gym. I bet you can do it. Younger than 65, you should be able to get up out of a chair without, again, sitting in these chairs with the bottoms that flip up, it's not going to be a fair test. And if you're older than 65, you should definitely, no one's older than 85, but all of you in this room should be able to rise from a sitting position without using your arms to help you push off. How many? Five. Should do it, yeah. Once is good. If you can do it five times in a row, if you were my patient and I was testing you in the exam room, I would give you a full pass for five times. And the sarcopenia affects all the muscles in all the skeletal muscle in your body. So the respiratory muscles, that is the muscles that are between your ribs. Turns out you actually really use those muscles to expand your chest wall to help you breathe. So if you really are losing a lot of muscle mass, makes it harder to take a big breath because you can't expand your chest the way that you used to. And also you have smooth muscle in your GI tract, but some of this loss of muscle can affect the muscle that your bowel uses to move things through. So I put more about the nervous system because this was cognitive aging and function. So again, what I'm about to tell you about are normal changes. And for those of you, I'm 56, and I can already feel that my brain is changing. It's not the same as it was. So there's neuronal loss in the brain throughout life, and the amount and location varies. So the loss is chiefly in the gray matter and not the white matter. So the gray matter is the actual cell bodies, and the white matter are the neurons that are covered with myelin that connect one nerve cell to another. So when you're losing cells in your brain and your spinal cord, it's the actual nerve cells, but not the connections that the cells have to each other, or less of that. And there's some evidence that although some neuronal loss occurs with age, many neurons actually have an increase in the dendrite growth. So that's the sort of the fingers, teeth, to use the Latin, which may at least partially compensate for the neuronal loss in some areas of the brain. So you are losing, and it's not possible that you're losing. You are truly losing. All of us in this room are some of our actual brain cells. But what can happen is those that are left are actually making more connections to each other, which are critically important for thinking and speed of processing. So slowed neuronal transmission secondary to the loss of complexity of neuronal connections and synthesis of neurotransmitters. So the other thing that happens is the chemicals that the brain cells make to communicate with each other, the amount of neurotransmitters actually decreases. You know, just don't make as much of those neurochemicals as you get older. And so if you're losing nerve cells and the nerves are losing some of their ability to communicate with each other, one of the normal changes with aging is increased processing time. So it just takes you longer to, for example, think of somebody's name or remember something in the past, or to do computations with the speed that you used to do it, or read a passage in a book and comprehend what you've read. You can still do all of those things. It just takes longer. And there is some short-term memory loss that comes with age. That's normal. But it is not progressive, and it doesn't impair your function. So Craig's going to talk about the pathology of memory loss, but that's different than normal memory loss. And the difference is that if you lose some memory that's a normal part of aging, it's not going to keep going and going and going until the point where you can't recognize family members, can't take care of yourself anymore. You'll have some short-term memory loss, but then it'll stop, it'll halt. And it won't affect your ability to function and take care of yourself. You might have to write things down a lot, but that should be about it. And then you also have slowed reflexes because you also lose nerves in your spinal cord. And that also can result in what's called loss of proprioception. So your ability for your feet, turns out you get a lot of messages from your feet and when you're walking. And you lose some of that, your body loses the ability to feed information from your feet back up to your brain. And there are also changes in sleep, and this is one of the most common complaints that we hear in clinic, as older adults very often have difficulty sleeping. So it turns out it's a myth that older adults need less sleep. Yep, if you were a 10-hour-a-night sleeper when you were 27, you're going to be a 10-hour-a-night sleeper when you're 87. Your body's need for sleep doesn't really change much as you get older. You know, some people can go on 4 or 5 hours of sleep. They can probably keep going on 4 or 5 hours of sleep as they get older. So, again, it's a myth that you need less sleep as you get older. But there are definitely changes with sleep. So it generally takes longer to fall asleep, which can be super annoying. The total time that you spend in REM sleep, so that's the dreaming state of sleep, decreases, and you spend less time in deep sleep. So that really restorative deep sleep becomes harder to get as you get older. And you spend more time in the lighter stages of sleep. And so what that means is that it's much easier to be aroused from sleep as you get older. It's just easier to be disturbed. So oftentimes patients will tell me that, oh, my bladder woke me up. But when I query them, turns out they were awake and they thought, oh, maybe I'll go to the bathroom while I'm awake. It's not actually their bladders that awakened them. They were already in a light stage of sleep and then decided they would, oh, I think I need to pee. That can be very burdensome. Even that normal change with aging can be very burdensome. Your sense of smell decreases. That's normal. And you also lose taste buds, and there's a range. We don't know exactly accurately to what degree, but sometimes it can be up to 60% of your taste buds can disappear. Your eyes. So your pupil loses some of its ability to dilate, so it's harder to see in dimmer light. And the lens loses fluid and becomes less flexible so that it's harder to see close up, and that's what's called presbyopia. That's why most of us need reading glasses as we get older. And you also lose some of the cones in your retina, and the cones are responsible for seeing color, so you lose the ability to see some colors as you get older, or colors become less vibrant as you get older. And you lose nerves in your inner ear and the otoliths that are in your inner ear to help with balance also get calcified and a little stiff. You can't, I don't know if you guys ever, when you were younger, played on the merry-go-round in the playground. Boy, or gone on a swing. Even, at 56, I can already tell that I get dizzy so much faster than I did when I was a kid. And it's because these otoliths get calcified, or it's one of the reasons. And I don't need to tell you that it's harder to hear as you get older. And so can't hear as well, and it's harder to localize noise, too. It's harder to tell where sound is coming from. So, that's all normal. However, in a study that's now 4 years old that was done by the AARP, they queried Americans aged 35 to 80, so I think, except for maybe Dr. Chodos, that includes everybody in the room, using a composite index of thriving based on several components of happiness. Respondents age 51 to 55 scored the lowest. Scores increase gradually with age, with the highest composite index of thriving for respondents age 76 to 80. So that's most people in the room. So despite all these normal physiologic changes and what really does feel like a loss sometimes, older adults are still, when compared to younger adults in this country, they're still really the happiest group of people in this population. Which then led me to introduce to you this concept of resilience. So resilience is the result of successful adaptation to adversity. And I would propose that these normal physiologic changes can feel like adversity when you used to be able to do something, and now you can still do it, but maybe not as well as you used to, or with great difficulty. You might have to struggle to do things that you used to be able to do easily. And that can be a real psychic challenge to a lot of people. Resilience is revealed by an individual's ability to cope and recover from crises, and there are plenty of crises that older adults experience. Certainly the biggest one in my observations is the loss of friends and family. It's revealed by an ability to sustain a sense of purpose and vitality and emerge stronger from stressful experiences. And it's a dynamic characteristic that can shift according to the circumstances. So you might have different coping responses depending on what the stressor or the adversity is. And in the handout I gave you, that's where these questions came from, so you'll be able to take these home, and we certainly aren't going to answer these questions tonight, but I wanted to leave you with questions rather than answers, because that's always more interesting, I think. So these are things for you to ponder after you leave here tonight. Why do you think you've lived such a long life? What is your life philosophy? How would you describe your relationships with your family, friends, neighbors? What do you do when you face difficulties in your life? What does being healthy mean to you? How do you handle change in your life? Are you satisfied with your life? What are you the most proud of? Are there lessons to learn from life's difficulties, or should we just grin and bear it? Are there any benefits that come from stress? So, as I said, I think one can describe the normal physiologic changes of aging as a type of adversity that older adults must respond to. And turns out most older adults are very good at it. And you really have a significant amount of control over how you respond and adapt to that stress. So with that, I will turn the microphone over to Craig.
Good evening, everyone. I'm going to talk about Alzheimer's disease and sort of typical aging versus non-typical aging. I'll be talking about the difference between typical aging and Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia. I love this because there are a lot of myths and around Alzheimer's disease and dementia that are out there, and I like to help clear the air. So the first myth versus reality is having a little touch of dementia is a typical part of aging. As we get older, yes, we do lose some of our cognitive abilities. We lose some of our abilities to maintain memories. However, getting older does not mean that we're going to, or we should, develop Alzheimer's or some other form of dementia. It's just one of the things that happens as we get older is that our risk for developing this disease increases. And I'll talk a little bit more about what is dementia, what is Alzheimer's, because that's another question that comes up a lot in the community. It's like, well, what's the difference between the two? Another myth versus reality. If you have memory loss, that means you have Alzheimer's disease or dementia. Just because we have those memory lapses, or for example, we go into the supermarket, we come out, and we can't find the car. How many, show of hands, how many times that's happened to you? pretty much everyone. No, having memory loss does not mean or equal having Alzheimer's or some other form of dementia. A lot of people get scared when they have those memory lapses. And we'll talk about, you know, the difference between just having a typical age-related memory lapse versus Alzheimer's in a short while. So just a little bit about Alzheimer's disease. So it's a progressive disease of the brain. It's a neurological disease. For quite some time, it was branded as a psychological disease, especially back in the early 50s and 60s, where people seemed to lose their mind and go crazy, and they were actually institutionalized. But however, what it really is it's a neurological disease that affects the neurons in our brain, the nerve cells that are responsible for everything that we do. You listening to me speak, breathing, eating. So it's less psychological and definitely more neurological in terms of its terms of a disease. Dementia is sometimes used instead of Alzheimer's disease, and they're actually two different things. So dementia is an umbrella term. It describes sort of the memory loss and the symptoms related to memory loss in terms of your inability to retrace your steps, the inability to maintain new information. It's just sort of a shorthand name that captures all of those aspects, all the aspects of memory loss. And usually there's a cause for the dementia symptoms. Sometimes those symptoms could be reversed. So it could be that you're having memory loss because of vitamin deficiency or the medication that you're taking, or depression. But more than likely, if you are showing signs of dementia, it's because of Alzheimer's disease. About 60% of the time, it's Alzheimer's related. 30, a different form of dementia. So it could be Lewy body disease. It could be frontal temporal dementia. It can be vascular dementia. And then the final 10% is more of the reversible dementias. And unfortunately, there is no cure for Alzheimer's disease. The medications that are available, they help reduce those dementia symptoms. However, once the disease starts, we cannot slow it down, and it continues until people unfortunately die from complications of Alzheimer's. And the one thing that we do know is that the biggest risk factor is age. As we get older, our risk for developing Alzheimer's or some other form of dementia increases significantly. So the 10 warning signs. First is memory changes that disrupt daily life. So again, when you have a sort of memory lapse, but perhaps you remember it later, that's fine. That's part of typical aging. In terms of the difference between the two, this is when it's really, really disrupting your life. So perhaps currently you can sit down and plan out your day, and that's fine, and you can go about it. Perhaps it takes you a little bit longer to get things done, but eventually it gets done. With Alzheimer's disease, it's much harder. For example, to get dressed in the morning, to sit down and actually go step by step, where do you need to go first, what do you need to do first. And in terms of maintaining new information, this disease tends to affect your short-term memory first, and then it affects the long-term memory. So that's why a lot of people are like, with Alzheimer's, and caregivers of people with Alzheimer's can't understand. It's like, you know, she can remember what she wore when she was 5 years old on her first day of school, but she can't remember something I just told her. And that's because, again, it's the new information that's affected, new memories that are affected with this disease. The second warning sign, challenges in planning or solving problems. So again, as I mentioned earlier, someone with this disease can no longer sit down and plan out step by step what needs to occur in order to get a task done. Bills, for example, is a major it becomes more and more difficult for someone to sit down and pay their bills. And there are a number of caregivers who perhaps the person with the disease was the primary bill payer, primary breadwinner, that wants to continue that. But unfortunately, they can't. And sometimes what ends up happening is that, you know, bills don't get paid, or they get overpaid, or just things that are supposed to be taken care of aren't taken care of. So it's just the unfortunate aspect of this disease. Number three, warning sign number three, difficult completing familiar tasks. So sometimes when we're driving, especially in San Francisco or even Oakland, things have changed. There's a lot more buildings, more construction. San Francisco is crazy in terms of how much has been changed in the last couple of years. So when you're driving around, you might get lost. However, eventually you can find your way. Someone with this disease, they can't do that. They can't sort of figure out, you know, what way, what avenue should they take to get around a new building, perhaps. Or they may go to the same place, perhaps you're still working or you're volunteering and they've volunteered there for a number of years, but all of a sudden they can't figure out how to get there. That's one of the warning signs, as well as sort of, again, like difficulties with remembering certain rules or just things in general that you do on a daily basis. That all of a sudden you're having difficulties remembering how to do it. Number four, confusion with time and place. So sometimes, especially as daylight savings rolls around, we get a little confused. Perhaps if we took a nap in the evening and we get up and it's 5 o'clock and it's pitch dark and we're trying to figure out, okay, what day is it and is it 5 o'clock in the morning or 5 o'clock in the evening? Eventually, though, we figure out which one it is. For someone with Alzheimer's disease, they lose that ability to track time, to understand why time has moved or why time has changed. Also, forgetting where you were. Again, sometimes we'll go into a room and forget what we went in there for. Maybe we're looking for something in the kitchen, and then we go into the kitchen, and it's like, what did I come in here for? Oh, that's right, I was hungry. But someone with this disease, they'll go into a room and unfortunately not even know what the room is made for or used for, and it can be in their actual house, their own house that they've lived in for a number of years. So that's a huge difference between sort of walking into a room and forgetting something or forgetting why you entered the room versus going to a room and not remembering what the room is, like where it is and what it's used for. Number five, trouble understanding visual images and spatial relations. Did anyone happen to see the movie Still Alice? A couple of hands, yes. In the book, and I believe in the movie as well, there's a scene where Alice, and for those who did not see the movie, it's an amazing movie and book about a woman who unfortunately was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's diagnosed in someone who is younger than age 65, which is a pretty rare and progressive form of Alzheimer's disease, but it can happen. Like there are individuals out there as young as 30 years old who have Alzheimer's disease. And in the book, she was trying to leave to go to work because she was believing that she still had a job as a university professor. But she got stuck at the door because all she could see was sort of a hole in the wall or in the floor, just a black hole. And it was because her brain couldn't process that there was a rug on the floor in terms of the colors. So she was sort of trying to get across this hole in the floor, but it was actually a rug. And that's something that happens with this disease versus, you know, typical age-related visual problems. Maybe you need a stronger medication, maybe cataracts or glaucoma sets in. So, number six, new problems with words and speaking or writing. So we've all had those moments where we're in, especially when we're in a deep conversation or a heated conversation, and we forget, okay, what word we want to use. And then eventually it comes back to us, probably when we're trying to go to sleep at 12 o'clock, restless from insomnia. But someone with this disease, they not only forget what the word is, but they forget how to use the word. So you'll have someone who will have a vacuum cleaner, and they'll say, well, can you get out that room thing? And did you mean vacuum cleaner? And as the disease progresses, a lot of people with the disease, especially if it affects them in this way, will start to talk as if they're speaking in riddles or in poetry. And you as a caregiver have to sort of figure out, well, what are they trying to say? What are they trying to explain to me? So it's unfortunate because it is one of the aspects of the disease, communication, that gets affected. Sometimes severely, and other times, it depends on who you are, not as much. Versus, you know, again, forgetting a word and then coming back to you later. Number seven, misplacing things or losing the ability to retrace steps. So this actually happens, or I've heard this occur a number of times from caregivers, where someone with the disease will accuse them of stealing their purse or their checkbook. And it's not that anyone necessarily is stealing from them. It's the fact that the person with this disease is hiding things, placing things in certain places, and they can't remember where they placed it. And it's like, well, in their mindset, everything is normal. And the fact that they can't remember where they put their purse, it's like, okay, well, obviously someone stole it. So you'll hear from a lot of caregivers that, you know, my mother is, or my father is accusing me of stealing her wallet. And sometimes this can be a very, very big issue when you have a loved one that's placed. They'll say that the nurses are stealing their medication, or their roommate is stealing their clothes. In actuality, it's just being misplaced by them. Number eight, decrease or poor judgment. So this is, again, something that we see a lot in someone with the disease. And it's always extremely terrible when this happens. But there have been instances where someone with Alzheimer's or some other form of dementia will give money away to telemarketers or give money away to strangers because they are losing the ability to actually make sound decisions, not just around finances, but just things in general. And lots of, like, elderly fraud can occur, and it can be extremely difficult for the entire family to deal with this. Versus, you know, as we get older, sometimes we just make bad decisions, and it's like, okay, I should have known better. Someone with the disease can't understand what's good and what's bad. Number nine, withdrawal from work or social activities. So sometimes we get older, we just want some peace and quiet, especially in this crazy, loud world that we live in. But someone with the disease, they perhaps sort of withdraw because it takes a lot to engage and stay connected to people. One of the things that happens with the disease is, or for people with the disease, is they lose the ability to track conversations and engage back and forth with the person that they're speaking with. And also it's a bit embarrassing to have this disease because people know that you're losing your cognitive abilities, and you yourself are knowing that you're losing your cognitive abilities. So it's more difficult to, and the desire to want to engage decreases. But we encourage individuals with the disease and caregivers of those, keep people engaged, because with Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia, you want to try to keep those neurons, those nerve cells as active as possible. But that does happen, that people sort of shrink away and withdraw. And finally, changes in mood and personality. There's actually a lot of research going on to see if this would be a good sort of indicator of someone who might be developing some form of dementia. So, you know, we all have our mood swings here and there. Maybe we didn't eat, or we're just tired, so we're a bit cranky. Or we might get more agitated as we get older. Last night I went to trick-or-treating with a bunch of kids, and it was just like, oh my God, this is so much work. I literally went home, ate, and went straight to bed. I was so exhausted. And that's part of typical aging. We just can't, it takes a lot more energy to deal with stuff. But with someone with this disease, their moods are shifting. And as the disease progresses, it shifts significantly. So you'll have someone who is extremely agitated or anxious, and then they'll start crying, and the next 5 minutes they're fine, as if nothing happened. So again, research is really looking into people who have severe mood swings or behavioral changes, if it is an indicator, or could it be an indicator for some form of dementia. So what should you do if you see some of those signs? I love to say this. If you see any of these signs in yourself, please do not diagnose yourself with Alzheimer's. It's a pretty long and thorough diagnostic process. So again, if you felt like, okay, I am anxious, more anxious than I was before in my 20s, or if I'm misplacing things, don't leave here thinking you have Alzheimer's or some other form of dementia. Do speak to your physician. Do talk about it. One of the biggest roadblocks to social support, support all around for those with the disease and their caregivers, and also barriers to research for better treatment and sooner cure, is that a lot of people will not talk about this disease. I love telling this story. When I go to health fairs, they'll see, like, you know, American Cancer Society and the ASPCA and Save the Whales, and then people just taking brochures, and they'll get to my table, and I'm like, oh, okay, I don't want that. And it's like, it's okay, take a brochure, because you want to be knowledgeable of what to look out for. And you want to be able to understand what this disease really is versus what it is, and how to reduce your risk. Because yes, you can reduce your risk for developing Alzheimer's. You can't prevent it, unfortunately, but you can reduce your risk through diet, exercise, keeping your brain active. So please do not be afraid of Alzheimer's disease. Please don't be afraid to talk about it and engage with the people who are actually living with the disease. Again, talk about it. See your physician if you do see these signs. And in my bio, it mentioned that I do marketing and outreach to medical professionals. And it's because, unfortunately, a lot of them aren't up to date with the latest Alzheimer's research. And we're definitely trying to improve that. So if you do speak to your physician, if you see some of these symptoms, and they serve as a road barrier to getting an actual diagnosis, or at least the diagnostic process started, simply, or if you can, see a different physician, because you want to know this information sooner than later, so you have time and the ability to make changes in your life for yourself and for your loved ones. You can also see, I'm just going to skip through that. You can also call our 1-800 number. It's a 24-hour helpline. So if you have any questions 7 days a week, you can call that number. You can also visit our website, alz.org, and for this information specifically, /10 warning signs, but our website is pretty substantial in terms of the information that we know about Alzheimer's disease. Just feel free to reach out to us with any questions or concerns that you may have. And if you want to be a volunteer and, you know, tell people in your community about Alzheimer's disease, definitely that's an opportunity as well. Or if you would like us to come out and speak more about this disease, we can do that free of charge. So with that, I say thank you very much. And yeah.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.